In this 100th edition of the BenGreenfieldFitness.com podcast, a trip down memory lane back to the very first podcast, how to make your kitchen healthier, calories burnt walking versus running, how long it takes to burn off caffeine, how long it takes to build tolerance to caffeine, whether caffeine after a workout helps, is aloe vera a scam, how to determine how much salt is in your sweat, how to know if you're running hard enough, and how often should you train in hot weather.
Welcome to the BenGreenfieldFitness.com podcast. We provide you with free exercise, nutrition, weight loss, triathlon, and wellness advice from the top fitness experts in the nation. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill, cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Well, folks, you finally made it to the 100th episode. I know some of you have actually listened to all of them. I don't know how you made it through 100 episodes, but if somehow you did, congratulations. Give yourself a big hand. Now, in today's episode, a little bit special on the featured topic, we're actually going to go back to the very first podcast ever. It's a little bit entertaining, actually, to hear the difference between that podcast and this one, but there's actually a lot of really great information in there. A workout of the week, some information on research at the National Personal Trainers Conference, a recipe for healthy chocolate peanut butter ice cream, and a little bit more. So about 20 minutes worth of podcasting there is for the featured topic in today's episode. Also, remember that all the questions this week were listener call-in questions. So a little bit different there on the listener Q&A, and we will do our special announcements, go on to the Q&A, and then move on to that featured topic. And remember, everything that you hear about today, I will put links in the show notes too. So just go to the episode show notes for episode number 100 at BenGreenfieldFitness.com. And thanks for your support of Ben Greenfield Fitness.
Get the inside edge from Ben Greenfield Fitness delivered straight to your phone. Just text the word fitness to 411247 and you'll instantly get exclusive VIP discounts and insider tips that no one else will ever see except you. Do it now. Text the word fitness to 411247 and you'll be in Ben's VIP text club for free.
Special announcements.
Now, if you subscribe to the free BenGreenfieldFitness.com newsletter, you already know all about this upcoming webcast that's on June 30th. It's a healthy cooking webcast put on by the highly entertaining Chef Todd. He actually did a great video post for us earlier this week that you should definitely check out at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, where he walked us through a farmer's market, showed us how to get fresh produce delivered to our house, and at the end of this week, he will be showing what he does with a fresh produce box that he gets at the farmer's market or has delivered. And the whole theme of this month for Chef Todd is how to cook with fresh, healthy ingredients. So I would definitely check out the link in the show notes to go sit in on Chef Todd's free webcast on June 30th. And you can actually listen to it after the webcast has been recorded, but to get the listening link, you have to register for the webcast beforehand. Now, in addition to that, the podcast over at the Get Fit Guy this week was on how to actually burn fat the fastest, which workout actually works to burn fat the fastest. And remember, those podcasts are only about 5 minutes long, but they're kind of jam-packed with snippets, and they're really, really dense in terms of the amount of advice that you get in 5 minutes. And just like this show, they're completely free. Now, the Marathon Dominator, for you running fans out there, is still available at marathondominator.com, as well as a 30-minute video that I shot to tell you a little bit more about how to actually train for a marathon without getting injured and how to put together a four-day-a-week running program. So check that out at marathondominator.com. And finally, if you want to join me in Thailand this winter for a double triathlon trip. There are still a few slots left for that trip. You need to email me very soon if you want in on that trip to Thailand. So if you're a triathlete and you would like to have a vacation organized for you to go race, then send me an email, ben@bengreenfieldfitness.com, and I can still get you into that race in Thailand, which is sold out, but is one of the best races in the world of all that I've been to in terms of triathlons. So check that out. We're going to move on to this week's listener Q&A. And remember that if you would like a Ben Greenfield Fitness t-shirt, you can either donate to the show and order one, or I'll tell you during the Q&A how you can get a Ben Greenfield Fitness t-shirt for free.
Listener Q&A.
Hi, my name is Sue, and I was wondering, it might be a strange question, but I think maybe you could help me out. We are remodeling our kitchen, and I was wondering if you had any recommendations on how we could design our kitchen to better facilitate health, fitness, and maybe even self-control and eating habits. And I think maybe you might have some good ideas before we get started here. So if you could address this soon, that'd be great. Thanks a lot, Ben. Bye-bye.
Well, Sue, that is a great question, and I wish that more people put a little bit more thought into not only how they design their kitchen, but how they approach their kitchen in terms of the way that they worked it into their lifestyle. So let's talk about some things that you can do with your kitchen and with your eating habits in your kitchen to actually help you do things like control your weight and eat healthier. Now, the first thing is that there has been research that shows that when people eat off of dinner plates that are smaller, they eat 22% fewer calories per meal. And in addition to that, since the 1970s, dinner plates have grown by 25%. So what this tells you is that if you stock your kitchen with smaller dining platters, then you're going to enable yourself to eat just a little bit less. That's actually one of the things that I'll do when I eat lunch. I used to grab a big plate and pile it with a huge salad or a really big wrap. And what I find now is if I use a smaller plate, I'm actually prone to eat less, even though it kind of fools my brain, because when I put a bunch of food on a small plate, it looks like I'm eating a ton of food. So by making sure that the larger plates are kind of more towards the back of your cupboards or more inaccessible, maybe saving those for some of your bigger holiday meals like Thanksgiving or Christmas, what you'll do is enable yourself psychologically to eat less. It's essentially a way that you can trick your brain. The next thing I would consider in the kitchen is that a lot of kitchens have a ton of lighting in them. And what research has shown is that the higher the wattage of the lighting, the higher your stress levels. And when your stress levels are high, your appetite gets stimulated and you tend to eat faster than usual. But on the other side, if your kitchen is too dim, research has shown that dim light actually reduces your inhibitions. That might be just because you really can't see what you're eating or how much you're eating, and so you eat more of it or eat some of the foods that you normally wouldn't. So the trick is to light your kitchen in a comfortable fashion without using too much light. So the recommendation from lighting experts is to not use more than 240 watts in your kitchen design. So that's the equivalent of 4 60-watt bulbs, or you could use 6 40-watt bulbs if you're doing a bunch of different lights. For compact fluorescent bulbs, you could use a few of the 75 to 100-watt compact fluorescent bulbs, but lighting actually affects your eating habits. So not too light, but also not too dim. Now, the other thing that's very important is that you not put your kitchen or set up your kitchen in a way that it becomes a dumping ground for things like your mail, for things you have to file that you haven't gotten around to yet. Essentially, the more organized and the more clean your kitchen is, the more likely it is that you will engage in less chaotic eating patterns. So they've done studies on this, and they've actually found that when people are distracted by things going on around them, they tend to eat about 15% more. So if you've got a bunch of mail that you're surfing through and you're being distracted by a bunch of other things going on in your kitchen, you're going to end up eating more. So what I would do is make sure that you reserve a space in your kitchen that's really designed just for eating and not for doing a lot of other activities, you know, such as watching TV or surfing through folders that are on your kitchen counter. In addition to the dinner plate issue, I would also pay attention to the issue with the glasses. Studies have also been done on glasses. I talk about this in my book, 100 Ways to Boost Your Metabolism, about how people tend to drink more when they drink out of large glasses. When people drink their calories in general, they tend to drink more. But by using smaller glasses in the same way that you use smaller plates, you're going to basically enable yourself to drink a little bit less. In addition to that, with large pantries that tend to have lots of bulk food stored in them in huge packages, you will tend to eat more. As a matter of fact, what research has found is that people will eat 23% more food when they're cooking from large containers, and they'll eat twice as much candy from big bags as compared to little bags. So while it can be helpful from a budget standpoint to shop in bulk, you may want to consider adding a space in your house outside your kitchen, outside the place where you'll be snacking, such as your garage or your basement, where you store a lot of your bulk food and the food that comes in big bags, and then you can transfer that to your kitchen and put it into smaller containers and ensure that you don't have large bulk sections of food cluttering up your kitchen, because you will be more likely to eat more when you're eating out of big packages. So here's an interesting tip as well. If you have snacks and you keep your snacks in clear jars, that actually makes you far more likely to eat, because when you see the snacks, you get this trigger that goes on in your brain, even if you're full, that you want to grab that snack. So if you tend to keep things like cookies, like mixed nuts, M&Ms, trail mix, things like that in your kitchen, you actually do yourself a favor by making sure that if it is in a clear container, it's kept out of sight. And even better yet, put it in a container that's not see-through. So none of your cookie jars should be like clear, big glass jars. And then finally, interestingly, on the same note as dinner plates being 25% larger than they were back in the 70s, kitchens are about 50% larger than they were back in the 70s. So again, a lot of things happen in the kitchen. And what you may want to consider doing if you're creating a huge kitchen, and that's the way that your kitchen redesign is set up, is ask yourself whether or not you actually need all that extra space, especially if any of that extra space is being devoted to the type of activities that are going to detract from your focus on eating and cooking. So for example, if you've got a space for a big TV or entertainment center in your kitchen, you may want to rethink that. If you've got space for bookshelves or magazine shelves in your kitchen, you may want to rethink that. Essentially, you want your kitchen to be a place for cooking and for eating and not for entertainment. So great question, Sue, and I hope that helps you out. Best of luck.
Hi, Dan. This is Daniel calling from Switzerland. First of all, I want to congratulate you for your qualification for Hawaii Ironman World Championship. Cool job, man. Now my question, it's about the following formula: how to measure how many calories you burn during a running session. My body gave me the following formula, which goes like body weight times distance, which you need for your run or for your race, which would equal in the calorie burn rate. For example, in my case, this would be 70 kilos, which is what in pounds? 2.2 is 154 pounds times, let's say, a marathon. This would equal in calorie 2,954. Now my question: is it really the same calorie burn rate no matter whether I run the marathon, let's say, in 3 hours or 3.5? Your input, your clarification would be highly appreciated. Thanks, Ben, and have a good one.
Okay, so first of all, before we get to the meat of Daniel's question, essentially that equation that he's referring to is an equation where you could take your body weight and you can multiply it by the distance that you traveled, and that will approximate the amount of calories that you burnt during that distance. Now, this works for the metric system. So that would be the amount of weight that you weigh in kilograms times the amount of distance you've traveled in kilometers, and that's supposed to give you an equivalent of the number of calories that you've burned. Now, according to that equation, Daniel is correct, meaning that if you run a marathon in 3 hours or if you run a marathon in, say, 3.5 hours, you're still going to burn the same amount of calories because you covered the same distance. Now, from a purely mathematical standpoint, that's true, but what the equation does not take into account is the dynamic nature of movement. Now, if you're listening to this and you're wondering how you could burn more calories with your training, this is going to be important information for you to know. Because even though you would technically burn the same amount of calories, say, walking a mile versus running a mile, the type of movement required to make your body run makes you breathe harder. Because you have to push your body off the ground, you have to swing your arms harder, and you essentially have to generate more movement if you're going to run a mile versus walking a mile. Now, when that occurs, when that increased movement occurs, you generate what is called oxygen debt. And specifically, you have a post-exercise oxygen debt. That means that when you finish exercising for a certain number of hours, you have to consume more oxygen than you would normally consume. And when you consume more oxygen, that oxygen is used to burn calories. So while you may burn the same amount of calories walking a mile versus running a mile, after you've finished running, you will continue to burn calories, resulting in a run generating, for example, an extra 100 or 150 calories after the workout. In addition, when you run, you cause your muscles to produce a greater amount of force. So you stimulate the ability for your body to grow new muscle, and you also stimulate your body to produce hormones such as growth hormone. And both of these will not only help you to stabilize your blood sugar levels a little bit more, but they'll also ultimately raise your metabolism. And this is why whenever you have the choice to go hard or go easy, you should go hard unless you are recovering or unless you're doing a very scientific-based, you know, triathlon periodization program where there are a lot of reasons to go easy versus going hard. But ultimately, what it comes down to is that you always burn more calories when you run than when you walk. So there's more to the equation than first meets the eye. So great question, Daniel.
Hey, Ben, this is Chuck Feerick. I had a question for this week's podcast. There are kind of actually four questions all based around caffeine. And I wanted to ask first, I know about how much to take before an OR training session or before an event, but is there any point at which I should redose if I was, say, doing a half Ironman? Would it be a good idea to take some more, like, halfway through the bike? Also, how much really makes a difference? I know we talk about like 200 to 300 milligrams or more or less, depending on body weight, but you know, there's a lot of energy gels with like 25 or 35 milligrams, and does that really make any difference? Next, can someone build up a tolerance like against caffeine where it becomes less effective and they have to take more? And lastly, I've read some research regarding taking caffeine post-workout with your recovery supplements, and it supposedly helps it get into your bloodstream faster and circulate around more to your muscles. And I wanted to see if there was really any validity behind that and if it was worth doing or whether or not you would recommend it. Thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to the podcast. Thanks, Ben.
Well, as Chuck already knows, and as you know if you listen to this podcast, caffeine can help you quite a bit with exercise. It helps to spare the use of carbohydrate as a fuel, so you use more fat, and it also makes you feel as if you're not exercising quite as hard, so you can usually push harder and feel less pain. Now, what Chuck is first wondering is exactly how much caffeine is actually gonna make a difference, or whether he's wondering whether the caffeine in something like a gel is gonna make a difference. Well, most of the studies find that the amount of caffeine that's necessary to really stimulate you to have a good what's called an ergogenic or a sports performance enhancing response range from 3 to 5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, and that's a lot of caffeine. For example, you know, for somebody, the average guy who weighs about 70 kilograms. If you're looking at 3 milligrams per kilogram, that's 210 milligrams of caffeine, and that's a few cups of coffee. And if you look at a lot of these sports gels, many of them contain 30 milligrams or 40 milligrams of caffeine. Well, sure, if you just took one of those gels, you're not going to feel it too much. But the idea is that if you are taking, say, 300 calories an hour, and each of those 300 calories is coming from a gel-based source, and the gel has 40 milligrams of caffeine for every 100 calories, well, suddenly you're getting 120 milligrams per hour, and that begins to take effect, especially if you're taking in this caffeine during a long event, like a 5-hour event or a 10-hour event. You end up dumping a lot of caffeine into your body. Now, while caffeine does have an ergogenic sports performance enhancing effect, it can do things like draw water into your colon and overstimulate your central nervous system. And chronic caffeine loads over a period of 10 hours, even to the range of, you know, 120 milligrams per hour, will leave you with things like diarrhea halfway through and the jitters. And eventually what happens is the central nervous system stimulation almost causes you to wig out. You start to feel really jittery and very moody, almost the same way as you would get if you experience low blood sugar. So just think about what would happen if you sat there during the day and drank, you know, 8 cups of black coffee. You kind of start to feel the same way while you're exercising. And that's why you need to use caution. A lot of these studies that have been done on caffeine have been done on people exercising for 60 minutes or 90 minutes and not out doing, you know, 10-hour Ironman events. So that being said, let's move on to the second part of your question to investigate this even further. And that is the actual rate of burning of caffeine. So basically, any molecule has what's called a half-life in science. And the half-life of caffeine, or the rate at which it's metabolized, is about 4.9 hours in a regular adult. Now, considering the fact that your metabolism is going to increase as you're exercising, you could generally give yourself a range of about 3 to 4 hours for caffeine to work its way out of your system and for its effects to begin to disappear. So if you were doing a long distance event of, say, 10 hours, you basically have a couple of choices. One is you could take in a bunch of caffeine about 30 to 45 minutes prior to that event, which is how long it's going to take caffeine to hit your system. And then you could continue to take smaller amounts of caffeine the entire time, such as by using the gels that I just talked about. If you incorporated this strategy, what I would recommend is that you only take in about 40 to 50 milligrams of caffeine each hour after you've taken that initial load of about 200 milligrams, and that will allow you to still experience the effects of caffeine without getting very jittery. And there has not been research done on this, but this is actually based on anecdotal experience with myself and with many of the athletes I coach. We've kind of figured out the exact amount of caffeine that lets you continue to do a longer distance event without actually burning yourself out in the process. Now, option two would be you take that initial dose of caffeine, you wait 3 hours, and then you take another dose of caffeine. And I've done this before, and it works pretty well. In that case, you'd want to make sure that you were taking in uncaffeinated gels or uncaffeinated sports drink, and then after about 3 hours, you would load with caffeine again using, say, like a pill or an energy powder or something of that nature, and you'd load with about the same amount as you used for that initial load 3 hours prior, so at least around 200 milligrams. So that answers that question. Then as far as your question about caffeine tolerance, your body definitely can reach a tolerance to caffeine. Basically, what studies have shown is that complete tolerance to caffeine can develop after about 18 days. So after you've taken caffeine for about 2.5 weeks, you begin to develop a tolerance to it, and that's according to research. Now, the issue with my with this research and my issue with it is that the research had people consuming 900 milligrams of caffeine per day. So they were drinking like 8 cups of coffee a day in order to develop that tolerance to coffee after about 2.5 weeks. So I haven't seen any studies that look at how long it takes to develop a tolerance when you're just drinking, say, 1 cup of coffee in the morning. I can tell you from personal experience that the effects of coffee begin to kind of wear off for me if I quit taking coffee and then start drinking it again after right around 2 weeks. So it could be that even the studies that use higher doses of caffeine still have an effect or still have a relevance with the lower doses of coffee that most of us drink when we're not in a research lab, being a coffee-guzzling guinea pig. So my recommendation ultimately is that if you're going to use caffeine to make yourself a better athlete, you abstain from caffeine for 7 to 14 days prior to using it, and that will ensure that you've actually deloaded from the caffeine and that you're not tolerant to its effects when you finally do decide to dose up. And then finally, you asked about whether you should take caffeine after a workout. And there's actually been interesting research on this. This is fairly recent research that shows that when individuals exercise and then they consume caffeine post-exercise, they can get up to 66% more carbohydrate in their muscles within 4 hours after exercise. Now, that may seem like a breakthrough concept, but here's the deal. Most of us are going to achieve that level of glycogen absorption within a day after a workout anyways. So the only people that should be, say, consuming a caffeine tablet or a cup of coffee post-workout along with their post-workout meal would be someone who's going to exercise again 4 hours later or a couple hours later or maybe in the afternoon after a mid-morning workout. If you're exercising every morning and you have 24 hours to replenish your carbohydrate stores, then there's no need to dump a bunch of caffeine on your central nervous system because you're probably going to reach that same level of carbohydrate absorption just through your day-to-day fuel. So it's not like the caffeine is going to help you store more fuel. It's going to help you store the same amount of fuel, but at a much faster rate. So it increases what's called your rate of glycogen reabsorption. So great question, Chuck.
Hey, Ben. This is a question for your podcast. It's about a product. I received a gift of a jar of Life Force Nutrition Greens with MSM. I was just wondering if you were familiar with the product. I like the product, but it costs like $50 a jar for 90 servings. And I was just wondering if this is a good value for this type of product, and is it necessary for somebody to be taking like 3 servings a day of this? And what is MSM, and what function does that have to do with the product? Also, if you got time. My wife has been approached to use the product from a Univera company. It's called Ageless Extra, and they make some great claims, and I was just curious if you ever heard of it. Seems like it could be just some kind of money-making scheme, but all right, hey, thanks a lot, and my email address is lowercase gb.anderson@att.net. Thanks, Ben. Love your program.
Okay, so this is basically a supplement question, and I looked into this Light Force Nutrition Greens, and first of all, Light Force does not have any information about their ingredients on their website. If anybody from Light Force is listening, let me give you a little hint here. you want to tell people the ingredients of whatever it is that they're ordering if you really want to make it in the nutrition industry, because you'll only get so many people who are going to put something into their body and have no clue what it is that they're putting into their body. So ultimately, it looks like Light Force, once I dug into it, is used by a lot of these martial artist type of fighters, mixed martial artist guys, UFC guys, and some of their big names use this Light Force High Energy Greens. And like many other green supplements, it contains a range of different herbs and, you know, spirulina, barley grass, kamut powder, alfalfa leaf, lemongrass, dandelion leaf. So kind of both a cleansing and a, what's called an alkalinizing product. All of these are high alkaline foods that would tend to help your body be in a less acidic state. Now, in that particular product, they've also included something called MSM, which interestingly, I discussed on the podcast recently. MSM is a naturally occurring sulfur compound. And while its precursor, DMSO, has been banned by the FDA, MSM still appears in a lot of primarily lotions for helping with muscle soreness. Now, the interesting thing about MSM is there really have not been any studies that have shown that it's done much for people in terms of soreness. Most of the evidence on MSM is primarily anecdotal. There was a big meta-analysis done on MSM, and a meta-analysis means that they looked at a bunch of different studies of studies, and no clinical significance was found that showed that MSM would be helpful in the reduction of pain for osteoarthritis. Now, that being said, tons of athletes swear by the stuff and, kind of like glucosamine chondroitin, say that they can feel almost immediately that decrease in joint pain. Most of those claims I haven't seen with oral intake of MSM, such as what you're getting with the light greens, but with like a lotion topical intake of MSM. So the MSM is one of those things where if you find that it helps your joints, then use it. There's not a lot of evidence that it could be harmful. That's not medical advice, but I'm just basing this on what the evidence shows. Not a ton of evidence to show that it helps, but not a ton of evidence to show that it's going to kill you or that it has a toxic effect either. As far as all the other ingredients in the greens, I've told people this before. If there's one supplement in my entire supplement protocol that I could take, it would be the Enerprime capsules or the Enerprime powder, and that's a greens supplement. Now, I've taken a lot of other green supplements, and I've never found one that I can actually feel the same way that I feel the Enerprime. I've actually had quite a few upset customers in the past couple of months because the spirulina used in Enerprime went on to back order, and the company that makes Enerprime refused to go with any other source of spirulina because what they were using was such a high quality source. And so this company really does not, it does not cheapen its product. It uses ingredients that are very high quality, and it doesn't cut corners in order to substitute ingredients if something happens to be out of season. I think this was due to floods in the area that they were getting their actual spirulina. So that being said, I am a big fan of green supplements, but I can't guarantee that this supplement is as good as the Enerprime supplement that I've talked about before. So that Light Force High Energy Greens could be something to look into. I'd also check out the Enerprime for sure. There's my shameless plug. And then you also ask about this Univera supplement, and that's really interesting. It's put out by a company called Univera. It's a multi-level marketing company that has several patents on a few different forms of aloe vera. And aloe vera has been something that's been touted as a medicinal and health product for a long period of time. Most of us are familiar with using aloe vera on sunburns to help with just the pain from a sunburn because it has like soothing, you know, moisturizing, healing properties on skin. But it's also been used in herbal medicine for a while. And no, you don't take the aloe vera lotion that you buy at the grocery store and chug it. Aloe vera is actually just like any herb. It can be put in like a capsule format, or it can be put in a liquid format to drink. And it's supposed to have antibacterial and antifungal properties. It's very high in amino acids. It's very high in a lot of different nutrients and minerals. And like many of these kind of fringe nutrition products, it is a little bit overpriced. I noticed that the company Univera actually kind of owns some patents and also has sponsored much of the latest research on aloe vera. And so it's tough to see some of the latest research as unbiased, but I did find one research paper that was an unbiased research paper, and it concluded that oral administration of aloe vera could be effective in stabilizing your blood sugar levels and reducing your cholesterol, and it also could be very useful as a treatment for genital herpes and for psoriasis, which kind of suggests that it does have these antifungal properties. So in terms of whether or not the patented formulation put out by Univera is superior to like a basic generic aloe vera that you could get at the grocery store, I can't say whether or not it is because I've never seen any studies that compare the two, and any studies that have been done on it have been sponsored by the company that's making the product. So very tough to say, but ultimately there is some research to back up aloe vera, just not necessarily to back up the high price stuff that you're going to find, for example, on that Univera website. Anytime you're looking into a supplement from a multi-level marketing company, a lot of times you are going to get a higher quality product, but sometimes to even out the extra that you pay for it, you almost have to join the company and make it part of your business so that it's supporting your investment in the product. So good question. And I'll put a link to the Enterprime in the show notes.
Hey, Ben. This is Patrick from just outside of Nashville, Tennessee, coming at you with another question. Now that it's starting to warm up a little bit and I'm sweating a lot more during my workouts, I got to thinking, if there was some way that I could measure my sweat for specific salt content, I'm not talking about sweat rate per se, but, you know, I'd be really embarrassed if Bioletics offers this, but, you know, some way that I can measure the amount of sodium, the amount of chloride, the amount of potassium, magnesium, and calcium in my sweat so that I can better know to replenish it. Thanks a lot, Ben.
So this is a really interesting question. I actually used to direct a sports performance laboratory where we did sweat sodium analysis using a protocol from the Gatorade Sports Science Institute. And what we would do is take a series of patches and put them at strategic locations on your body, and each patch was a specific size. You would then sweat on a bicycle or a treadmill for an hour. And we would determine not only how many ounces of liquid you lost during that exercise period, but we would also measure the amount of sodium that ended up in each of those patches from each different site of your body. And then we'd take the algorithm developed by the Gatorade Sports Science Institute and essentially, based off the surface area of your body, determined how much salt you were losing for each ounce of liquid or fluids that you lost, or for each pound that you lost. And it was really interesting. Most of the time, people were losing anywhere from 1.5 to 2.5 grams of salt per hour, which is what you would expect. But interestingly, there, based on that, is essentially a formulation that you can use to determine approximately how much salt you lose per liter of sweat or per ounce of sweat. And that can help you to determine your sweat or your sodium replacement rates if you weren't going to just go to a lab and get tested. So what we know is that for every liter of sweat that you produce, you have about 2.5 to 3.5 grams of salt that's lost in each liter. So if we were to round that up to 3 and say that you were to lose 3 grams or 3,000 milligrams of salt for every liter of sweat, the next thing that we would want to do is figure out exactly how many liters of sweat you are losing per hour. And if you assume that most of what you lose is salt and you go weigh yourself after exercise, essentially for each pound of weight that you lose, you can assume that the conversion to number of liters lost is about 0.5 liter. So if you lost 1 pound, and that's 0.5 liter, and we know that there's 3 grams of salt in 1 liter, for each pound that you lose, you'd be going through about 1,500 milligrams or 1.5 grams of salt. And you can generally replace salt at about anywhere from 30 to 50% of what you've lost. Really, really heavy sweaters are going to be wanting to replace closer to 50%. So you would be taking anywhere in the range of, you know, right around 500 to 750 milligrams of salt per hour, if that were the state that you're in. So that is how you would go about doing it. You would want to weigh yourself before and after exercise, and then you would want to use the fact that a liter of fluid loss is going to be the equivalent of losing about 3 grams worth of salt, and then replace your salt at about the 30 to 50% rate of loss. And that's when it comes down to experimentation. I would start with 30%. If you're still cramping, ramp it up a little bit. If you're cramping again, ramp it up a little bit and kind of get to that point where you can take in enough salt. If your fingers start to get puffy, if you start to see a lot of white salt, you know, on your pores and your armpits, etc., that probably means that you're taking in too much of it.
Hey, Ben, my name is Luke, and I've been competing in triathlons for about 2 years now. My question has to do with race performance. I hear a lot of people talk about how they're running through pain during the run portion of a race and how they, you know, are sore for several days or weeks after a race. And when I'm running, I don't get that feeling during a race. I feel like I'm pushing it pretty hard, but I don't feel like I'm running through pain. I don't collapse at the finish line. And I guess my question is, should I be feeling those things? Should I run to the point where I'm in pain during a race? I don't know if it's just a mind thing or if I am not training hard enough to know what it feels like to exert myself that way during the run portion of a triathlon. So I've done everything from sprints to half Ironmans. I don't know if that, if the distance varies, makes a difference on how hard you should push it. So I guess that's my overall question is, should I be running in pain during a race? Should I be pushing it that hard?
Okay, so Luke, as a coach, my short answer to your question is, yeah, you should be hurting during the run. If you're not hurting, you're probably not pushing yourself hard enough. But I don't want to leave you hanging with that. So one of the things that can occur in individuals is they can either have lungs that are overpowering their legs or legs that are overpowering their lungs. Now, in the former case, if you have lungs that are overpowering your legs, what that means is that you're one of those people who is very aerobically gifted, but you don't have much leg strength. And so while you can run all day long and feel like you're breathing just fine, you can't run that fast because you're not able to generate that much force. You usually don't do well on the hills. You essentially don't have the musculature to be able to push yourself to that speed. So if you're a real, real skinny guy, a lot of times that's the case, and you can benefit from doing things like hill work, lunge work, plyometric work. Now, if your legs are overpowering your lungs, you're typically somebody who's come into the sport with a background of power or explosive or strength sports, and your aerobic system is not that well developed. And in that case, you would want to sacrifice too much, you know, weightlifting type of work or explosive sports type of work and do a little bit more aerobic type of conditioning, like, you know, doing 5 to 10 minute tempo repeats on a treadmill at a slight incline, or doing, you know, 2 to 5 mile repeats on your bike. And so the training can really affect how your body responds in terms of getting the legs to catch up with the lungs or the lungs to catch up with the legs. Now, this can be very mental as well. I've got an article coming out soon in a triathlete magazine about mental tactics for getting yourself to push harder during exercise. And what I find is that people who grew up playing sports really don't have any trouble at all getting themselves to push to the next level. But sometimes people who didn't play a lot of sports, who never really were at that point in their life where they had a coach pushing them to the point of puking, they don't know what it feels like to push hard, or mentally they haven't really taken their body to that stage, and so it's tough to get to that stage in a race later on in life. Now, that's just simple practice. That's a lot of times something that's improved by going out with other people who are going to push you, going to a master swim group, getting out on the road with a group of road cyclists or other triathletes, joining a track club or doing your workouts with runners who are faster than you, who are going to push you. If you have a lot of extrinsic motivation, that can help you quite a bit. Now, if you're not extrinsically motivated, if other people pushing around you don't really tend to make you want to take it to the next level, then sometimes you have to use some intrinsic motivation to push yourself. You have to ask yourself, You know, why are you doing what you're doing? What is it that you want to achieve? Do you want a podium slot? Do you want a PR? Do you find that the increased fitness that you gain when you push outside your comfort zone is something that you like, both in the way that you look and in the way that you feel? And you can use some of those elements to actually convince yourself to push a little bit harder. But ultimately, what it comes down to is that unless you're, for example, doing a really, really long event, like an ultra distance, you know, 50K, 100K, 100-mile type of ultra marathon, then your intensity should be such that you are feeling it quite a bit. The feeling of pain or discomfort is always relative to the distance. In a 5K road race, you're going to be running a lot faster and harder than you are going to be in an Olympic distance triathlon, than you are going to be in an Ironman triathlon or a marathon. But really, there's always a level of discomfort that you should feel during the race. And when you get to that point, you'll know it the next day. You'll be sore after a race, and you'll think, okay, I really did give it my all. So, great question.
Hi, Ben. My name is Toby Hunter. I'm from Clarksville, Tennessee. My question is for your podcast. I'm training in the South. The last 2 weeks, it's been 95 degrees with 90% humidity, heat index about 105. Unfortunately, the only time I can do my runs is about high noon. And my question is, training in that heat, is there any benefit to that? Because I'm obviously slower. My heart rate zones are all out of whack. I blame it on the heat, but, you know, is it affecting me that much? You know, I'm about 10 beats higher per minute, so I just don't know how to train in that heat, and am I getting any benefits, and do I need to change my strategy in that kind of condition? Most of my races are not going to be that hot, but, you know, triathlons are generally hot, but usually not heat index of 105. So I listen to your podcast all the time, so maybe this will make it. Thank you. 931-320-2845. Thank you.
So training in the heat can be tough. Not only do you force your body to shunt a bunch of blood volume to your extremities to cool you off, so your heart beats a lot harder, but you tend to lose a lot more salts, deplete electrolytes. Mentally, it's much more difficult. You tend to have a higher rating of perceived exertion, so you feel like you're working a lot harder when you're out there in the heat. And you are correct, and it can really feel like you're beating up your body when you're going out and training in hot weather every day. And so the question is, you know, if there are diminishing returns, if you get to that point where mentally and physically the amount of dehydration that you're experiencing and the amount of mental strain that you're experiencing by daily training in the hot weather, the question is, can you get to a point where you just have to do that every once in a while? And the answer is that studies have shown that once you acclimatize to heat, fully acclimatize to heat, which actually takes 14 days of exercise in the heat for anywhere from 90 minutes to 2 hours, then you can retain those heat acclimatization benefits for about 1 week. And then you start to lose those and almost fully lose your heat acclimatization after 3 weeks. And so if you were to spend 14 days, 2 weeks, and you were to get through those 2 weeks, then technically after those 2 weeks, if you were able to even go out and just do a weekly 2-hour hard effort in the heat, you could sustain your heat acclimation pretty well. Now, I've found for myself with personal experience, and I've read that a lot of coaches, there's not been any studies done on this, but a lot of coaches have done this. They'll generally get their athletes out there every 3 days at least in the heat to exercise. So what it comes down to is if you were to exercise, you've already been exercising in the heat, you've gotten a couple weeks under your belt, you could get away with going out there just once a week or a couple of times a week. And if mentally you're able to get yourself to work out with more consistency when you're exercising, for example, in an environmentally controlled gym or something of that nature, then you know, you may actually do yourself some favors and also help yourself from a recovery standpoint. Now, I personally, when I'm, for example, getting ready for a Hawaii Ironman triathlon, and I live in Spokane, Washington, where it tends to be a little bit chiller through September and through the October leading up to that race, I will, every 2 to 3 days, do a session indoors, either on the treadmill or on my indoor trainer with a heater and a humidifier. And that's as frequent as I do it. I don't go out every day and beat myself up in the heat for multiple training sessions. I just get in there every 2 to 3 days and do a session. And typically, I don't even go 90 minutes to 2 hours. I'm usually around 1 hour that I get a heat acclimatization in. And I generally feel okay with that. I'm sure it would feel even better if I was going 90 minutes to 2 hours, like a lot of the studies do. But you know, ultimately, it comes down to how long you can sit your butt on an indoor bike trainer with a heater and a humidifier on. So, great question, Toby. And then we have a little bit of feedback from listener Chris.
Hi, Ben. My name's Chris. I'm a frequent questionnaire listener of the show. I just wanted to call you and tell you how much I appreciate your show and the wonderful information that you give. You just do an amazing service, and I can't believe you do it for free. This next bit you can take off the air. I hope you don't have to use it on your show if you don't want to, but because I don't want to seem like I'm bragging. I just did the road race at the Paracycling National Championships in Bend, Oregon, and I went from being a couch potato 1 year ago to placing third in a field that competes internationally, and I owe a lot of that to the great advice I hear from your podcast. So I just wanted to thank you personally, and there you go. Awesome time, man. Take care. Bye.
Well, I thought that'd be a fitting call to end the Q&A section on. And Chris, don't worry. You didn't appear to be too haughty in your bragging there. I'm happy for you. I'm happy that you found value in the podcast. And I thank you and all the rest of the listeners for supporting me. Every week I receive a donation from at least one person who decides to support the podcast, which is fantastic and helps out quite a bit while I'm doing the research and the preparation to get these out to you. And you can actually donate yourself. If you go to the show notes for any episode and scroll down, there's a little button there that allows you to donate. And anybody that ever donates more than $15, I always send a t-shirt to, a free Ben Greenfield Fitness t-shirt. Now, this week, the other way that you can get a t-shirt is to ask a question in a new way. This is a new thing that we're doing, but I'm going to send a free t-shirt to the best question of the week that is asked through Twitter. Now, if you've not been on Twitter before, you can click on the link that I have there in the show notes to go to Twitter and check it out, sign up for free, and it's always free. And my Twitter name is Ben Greenfield, and all you have to do is go to my Twitter page, and there's a little button there where you can leave me a message, or you can use the @BenGreenfield to leave me a message, and you need to make sure that you're following me in order to leave a message, so make sure you push the Follow Ben button, and then leave me your question. And the best question of the week that's asked through Twitter, and you got to be creative because Twitter questions can only be 140 characters long, I am going to get your address from you and send you a t-shirt. So I'll put a link to Twitter in the show notes along with a link to everything that I talked about. So a few different ways to get your t-shirt there. You can either donate to the show and you can also ask a question through Twitter. So we're going to move on to this week's featured topic, which is the very first podcast ever released from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Enjoy.
Welcome to the BenGreenfieldFitness.com podcast. This is your weekly free audio exposure to cutting-edge fitness, diet, and wellness news. Hey, whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, this podcast is going to present you with the latest exercise and nutrition content from the nation's top experts. My name is Ben Greenfield. I'm a personal trainer, certified nutritionist, and exercise, diet, and wellness guru. Each week, I'm going to be bringing you cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and wellness advice. Stay tuned for this week's podcast from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. In this week's podcast, a preview of the interviews that are lined up for the weeks to come. Workout of the week, round and round, with an accompanying exercise video, book review of the brand new title, Run With No Pain. healthy recipe for chocolate peanut butter ice cream, and a special preview of the National Personal Trainers Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. Before I let you know about the interviews that we're going to be featuring in the next several weeks at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, let me point out the fact that I did include in this week's show notes that there was going to be an interview with Brian Rhodes, pro triathlete. Unfortunately, en route to the venue where I was going to be interviewing Brian Rhodes, a triathlon at which we were both competing, I stepped on and broke my headset microphone piece that I use for interviewing. So that interview never happened. I'm going to be interviewing Brian Rhodes via Skype, however, sometime this week or the week after. And I'm primarily going to be asking him questions about injury prevention, rehabilitation, and nutrition. So in addition to that interview, some of the other interviews that are going to be coming down the pipeline are a massage therapist interview on the four different types of massage therapy that you can have done as an athlete, depending on the type of depending on the time of the training year that you're in. We're going to have an interview with a naturopathic physician from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, on the differences between naturopathic and allopathic medicine. We'll be interviewing a representative from Mount Kapper Nutritional Products on the benefits of probiotic supplementation and also a type of protein that might be absorbed about 20 times faster than current whey proteins on the market. We'll be interviewing Dr. P.Z. Pierce on exercise as medicine. I'll have an interview with a couple of podiatrists, one on how custom orthotics can help your knee, your hip, or your back pain, another podiatrist on high-performance bicycling orthotics and how to get them. We'll be talking to a chiropractor about common low back injuries and what chiropractic actually does to help those. We'll be talking to a dentist about dental health and immune system integrity and the link between those two factors. And then finally, we'll be talking with a certified dietitian on why your nutritional habits may be setting you up for diabetes. So in the next few weeks, we'll have all sorts of content and guests here at BenGreenfieldFitness.com. So be sure to subscribe to the podcast. You aren't going to want to miss a lot of the content that's coming down the pipeline here at BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Book review. If you go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com and click on books and DVDs, each week we'll be featuring a different book and DVD. Because this is one of the first podcasts that we've put out, I actually am going to talk about one of my recent books that just hit the web. It's called Run With No Pain. And I based this book off the past decade that I've spent as an endurance athlete and coach. Dozens of my cyclists and runners have at one time or another experienced this debilitating low back pain. Primarily limited power production on the bike, stride length, and push-off while running. Usually, the origin of the pain was a little bit mysterious, and it couldn't be traced back to a single episode of acute injury. But it was typically described as kind of a radiating discomfort, typically located on one side or the other, and a lot of these athletes would feel it when they were cycling, when they were running, and the pain and the slight weakness or tingling tended to manifest more significantly when they were sitting for long periods of time, especially with their legs crossed, when they're riding a bicycle in a bent over time trial arrow position, or when they're running, especially on a hard surface for a long period of time. And there were certain activities that kind of relieved the pain. I noticed that when they did hip flexor stretching, hamstring stretching, yoga, non-weight bearing exercise that improved blood flow to the low back, lying on their back with the feet up, especially on, for instance, a heating pad, and then side-to-side movement, a lot of these activities would seem to relieve some of the low back pain. But I basically, since I'm not a medical professional or a sports medicine physician, coached a lot of these athletes through their pain without providing specific rehabilitation protocols. And that was basically until I actually injured myself in the same way. And it was during a deadlift exercise that I actually injured my back. I spent several months rehabilitating my low back and avoiding running, cycling, any type of heavy lifting. And eventually that acute pain disappeared. But over the course of the next several months, I noticed myself experiencing a lot of the same symptoms that my athletes were complaining about. Tingling on one side with a little bit of weakness while I was running or bicycling. Pain with extended periods of time in the seated position. and kind of a popping sensation in the low back with a lot of the rotational stretches that I would perform. So that discomfort kind of severely affected my training, my race performance, and I started to research what exactly was going on. So I learned about the SI joints, the sacroiliac joints, and how they're considered a source of most of the low back pain that occurs in athletes or really any individual, and a compression of the pelvis or an asymmetry, meaning a rotation in one direction or the other of the hips, can cause joint dysfunction and causes the pain that we feel in the low back if the low back is out of rotation. So this development of asymmetry actually causes different muscles in your low back to actually assume an improper muscle length, primarily your hip rotator muscles. So usually what happens is your lateral hip rotator muscles shorten and your medial or your inside hip rotation muscles actually lengthen. And when the lateral muscles shorten, the entire hip bone is pulled posteriorly towards the shortened side, and that can cause the nerve pain that originates from the sacroiliac joint, which a lot of runners and cyclists and athletes actually feel. One really good resource that I found on this was a book called The Malalignment Syndrome by an author called Wolf Schamberger. It's a really big book. It was about 450 pages long, and I can't just give that to people to read, without actually giving some more specific advice that might be a little bit more practical and quick for you. So what I did was I actually gleaned the most practical information from that book that I could, along with a lot of the information from discussions that I had with sports medicine professionals, physical therapists, chiropractors, and massage therapists. And so what I began doing was designing an exercise routine that I could do every day to actually bring my hips back into proper rotation. So for 4 weeks, on about 4 to 5 days of the week, I perform the exact routine that I lay out in this new book, Run With No Pain. And my pain began to disappear. My back quit popping. The weakness and the tingling on one side of the leg while I was running and cycling was no longer present. And so I basically put the routine together into about 10 simple stretches and exercises, and I began to recommend them to my athletes. And within a couple of months, almost every one of my athletes had not only reduced or completely eliminated their low back pain, but the power meters on their bikes and the lap splits on their runs were starting to show PRs. So basically their pain disappeared and they got faster. And so what I've done is actually created a website called runwithnopain.com. I filmed all the exercises, created videos for them, and then put together a little bit of an ebook that lays out the exact exercise routine that I designed for myself and for these athletes based off of the research that I did to eliminate low back pain during running, cycling, and basic athletic movement. So check it out. The web URL is runwithnopain.com, and the book, the videos are all accessible from that website, runwithnopain.com. Check it out. All right, fitness fans, this week's workout of the week can be found at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Click on videos. You'll get instant exposure to a video there that will show you how to do each of the exercises in this week's workout. It's called Round and Round, and this one starts off easy and gets a little bit more difficult as you go through. You're going to shoot for anywhere from 3 to 6 rounds of the Round and Round workout. What you're going to start off with is 5 swing squats per side. You'll move on to 30 to 60 seconds of a maximum cardio effort of your choice. That can be biking, running, rowing, elliptical trainer, jumping jacks, whatever you can get your hands on. After you finish that maximum cardio effort with minimal rest, you're going to drop down to the floor and do 5 super slow push-ups. Modify those to knee push-ups if you need to. Once you finish those 5 knee push-ups or regular push-ups, you're going to move on to 5 mountain climbers per side. Then find a pull-up bar, assisted pull-up machine, or lat pull-down machine. Complete 5 reps and then finish with another 30 to 60 second cardio effort of your choice. All right, once you've finished those stations, you'll move back around to the beginning and start with 6 swing squats, another 30 to 60 seconds of cardio, 6 push-ups, 6 mountain climbers, 6 pull-ups or pull-downs, and again, a cardio effort of your choice. If you go 6 times through this circuit, again, you're going to be looking at about 10 reps on everything, by the time you're done. So you can check out the video for this workout with the instructions for each exercise at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Click on videos. Have a great workout. Today's recipe can be found at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Just click on nutrition. And this recipe in particular is one that has saved a lot of my nutrition clients from committing dietary suicide when they get their sweet tooth. Basically, it's a way to get chocolate peanut butter ice cream without getting all the calories and the saturated fat and the sugars. There's a website that I mentioned in this podcast, and I'll put the URL for this website in the show notes, but it's nutritiondata.com. And if you go there, you can get the exact nutritional label for just about any food on the planet. I haven't checked to see if rattlesnake or alligator or any of those type of things are on there, but for the most part, if you can eat it, it's going to appear on this website. And what you want to do is check out what you're actually getting. If you type in something like chocolate peanut butter ice cream, you'll come up with about 400 to 500 calories, about 70 to 80% of that from saturated fat, and anywhere from 35 to 45 grams of sugar, pure sugar. So basically that means for about a 3/4 cup serving or about 10 spoonfuls of ice cream, you are getting a boatload of calories. One of the things that you can do is to make your own substitution for chocolate peanut butter ice cream at home. And what you want to find is just plain, regular, fat-free yogurt. I know it doesn't taste that great, but you're going to make it taste good. You want to take about half a container of that, which is right around 60 calories worth. And then take some almond butter or some peanut butter. Make sure if you're using peanut butter that it's the stir-style peanut butter, far lower in hydrogenated fats, much better for your heart. Anyways, you use just almost a tablespoonful of that. So we're talking anywhere again from around 60 to 70 calories. You're going to add that to the yogurt, and then you're also going to take either about a quarter of a dark chocolate bar or a tablespoonful of Hershey's chocolate, or you can use little Ovaltine or hot cocoa powder as well, depending on what you like, what kind of texture you want. You add all this together, you stir it, you put it in the freezer for about 20 minutes. When you take it out, you get something that closely resembles the taste of a Reese's peanut butter cup. Try it out. You're looking at about 200 calories, far less saturated fat, far less sugar, much healthier for you. It helps you satisfy that craving that you might get for a dessert every now and again, and it tastes great. You can check it out again at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Click on nutrition. As promised in the introduction of this podcast, I'm going to be giving you a little preview of the National Personal Trainers Conference and Exhibition happening this July 9th through 12th, 2008, down at the Paris Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada. I will be traveling down there to listen and participate to some of the latest, greatest news coming from the fitness and nutrition industry. And every day while I'm down there, I'm going to be sitting down and giving you a fresh look at some of the new topics that are coming at us from a fitness and a nutrition perspective, and quite a bit of helpful information for you to achieve your performance goals, your weight loss goals, your nutrition goals, whatever the case may be. If I have the opportunity, I'm also going to be trying to get some interviews with some of the top fitness professionals in the country to get their perspective on crucial issues in the exercise and nutrition industry. So on Thursday, a few of the more interesting topics of the day are going to be secrets of the Navy SEALs goal setting and training methods. We'll also be looking at nutritional supplementation during resistance training, some of the latest science and some of the latest recommendations to maximize the anabolic effects of resistance training, as well as the post-workout nutritional recovery. We'll be looking at some interesting recent research findings on calcium and weight loss, the role of fitness in the treatment of eating disorders, how resistance training differs from endurance training in its effect on the cardiovascular system, specifically arterial compliance, which is basically blood vessel wall elasticity. And then finally, we'll be looking at the influence of dexterity training on injury prevention and common musculoskeletal compensation patterns for basic movement mechanics, so that you can determine essentially if, for instance, your knees go in front of your toes on the squat, what might be compensating and what might be weak when something like that happens. So, let's go ahead and move on to Friday. Friday, we're going to be looking at some ways to actually introduce screening and corrective exercises for problem shoulders, essentially that don't respond to conventional exercise and stretching. So I'll be talking about how to use trigger point techniques and free weight techniques to help rehab your shoulder or strengthen a shoulder problem. We're going to be looking at performance training for the aging athlete, which is basically going to look at a new sport conditioning paradigm called the TWIST sport conditioning protocol. And it's going to teach how to take an aging athlete and actually reintroduce the aging body to high-performance athletics. We'll be looking at some ways to actually apply power research into your training. And then also an interesting discussion will be on resistance training for hypertrophy, which is basically muscle growth, why some people's muscles grow fast and some people's muscles really don't grow that much at all. One other thing, the effect of the length of the rate of the rest interval between your exercise sets and how that's going to actually affect the effectiveness of your exercise training program. So let's go ahead and move on to Saturday and check out what we're going to look at on Saturday. So on Saturday, we'll be looking at functional training and what functional training actually is. We'll define it and talk about how to implement it in your own training protocol. We'll also be looking at periodization programs, and this would basically be how to split your year, your fitness program during the year into different periods of time, where during each period you focus on a different aspect of your fitness so that you constantly grow fitter from week to week and month to month. We'll be looking at plyometric training. One interesting talk will be on how to train 12 to 16 year old age groups. And that should be interesting. I don't know if any of you have children, but we'll be talking about psychobehavioral development, lifestyle management, literacy, musculoskeletal, and energetic considerations for the 12 to 16-year-old athlete population. One of the other real interesting things that we'll be looking at on that Saturday session is how to train the endurance athlete in the gym, and basically how the strength training protocol of a marathoner, a triathlete, or a road cyclist, whether recreational or professional, is going to differ from the type of training protocol of a strength athlete. And then finally, we'll be looking at some recovery techniques to prevent overtraining, to maximize the actual response to training, and allow you to train day after day without actually getting injured or ill. So Thursday through Saturday of next week, there'll be some real exciting stuff coming down the pipeline from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast. It's free. You can do it in iTunes. If you go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com and you click on how to subscribe, if you've never subscribed to a podcast before or a blog, I lay it out right there, make it real easy to understand, and you can get started right away. So tune in next Thursday for news from the NSCA Personal Trainer National Conference. Hi, podcast listener. This is Ben Greenfield. That's all the content for today from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Obviously, this first podcast gets a little rough around the edges, and we do have some work to do and a little bit more content to present in coming podcasts. But what I would like you to do, if you get a chance, is just to go to iTunes and click on the Write a Review button underneath Ben Greenfield Fitness, and you don't even have to write a review. Just click on 5-star. Give us a good rating so that we can get to the top of iTunes, get as many people as possible to listen into Ben Greenfield Fitness. The more support that I get for this podcast, the better and better it's going to become. I have to tell you, I am really, really excited about the things that we're going to be presenting on Ben Greenfield Fitness. I know there's a lot of people out there that are into kind of that ideal combination of healthy nutrition, weight loss, performance, outdoor sports. That's the type of person that's going to listen to this podcast, and that's the type of content that I'm going to bring to you. So I will speak to you on Thursday night from the National Personal Trainers Conference in Las Vegas. Until then, this is Ben Greenfield, over and out.
And this also is Ben Greenfield, about a year and a half later, but it's still me. So that's going to wrap up our show for this week. And remember, if you have questions, you can email Ben at bengreenfieldfitness.com. You can call toll-free to 877-209-9439, or you can Skype Pacific Fit. Remember to check out that free healthy cooking webinar on June 30th and access the link to that in the show notes to this podcast. Remember to check out the Get Fit Guy. And for that podcast or this podcast, leave a ranking in iTunes and feel free to donate on the show page as well if you'd like. Leave your question to the Twitter page at twitter.com/BenGreenfield to be eligible to win a free t-shirt if your question is the best question. And then remember, if you want to accompany me to Thailand this winter for a triathlon, then you need to email me very soon if you're a triathlete and you like adventure travel. So until next time, this is Ben Greenfield, hoping that you'll stick with me and learn with me through the next 100 podcasts from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Have a great week.